This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're continuing our look at the reporters that have put out stories in print and online, in this case, over the air and online. We're talking with Indiana Public Broadcasting Education reporter Eric Weddle. He works out of WFYI Public Radio and TV in Indianapolis. And in fact, you can see his story on WFYI's website if you want to check it out in print, so to speak. And Eric is with us. Thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's an interesting article, and especially in particular that it mentioned in the first paragraphs of the article about the fact that Hoosier officials are not using any specific metrics to be able to guide any local school district leaders when they're trying to decide about reopening schools and whether to stay virtual or not as we get close to when classes should begin, but we're still in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. Tell us a little bit about, in your article, about what State Health Commissioner Dr. Christina Box had to say.
Right. So, I mean, right now, school districts have received lots of guidance, you know, from the State Department of Education. They put out a big document in June, and there's all kinds of guidance on just, like, maybe how to operate classrooms, social distancing, face masks, teaching, and so forth. But there really hasn't been direct guidance for, like, metrics a school district should be looking at to decide, is my community, you know, in a safe place during this pandemic to bring students back into the classroom? And so some states have started to do this. New York State recently announced that they want COVID infection rates to be at 5%. If it's below 5%, a school in that region can open. Mm-hmm. But if it's higher, the schools can't. So in talking to school leaders in Indiana, they've just been kind of, you know, allowed to decide on their own in consultation with local health care department, you know, in their counties. And so a lot of school leaders have been wanting more a line, you know, a line, do not cross this line,
yeah,
to get at a threshold. And so recently the state health director mentioned that, yes, we do not have that metric, but if we start to see the rate climb up, at that time it was 7.1% was the infection rate of her comment, and she just said if we get below that 10% infection rate in the state, perhaps a mandate or more guidance from the state could happen to schools on whether they should be opening or whether they should be pulling back on classes being in person.
Now, I know you had a chance to talk with Indiana State Teachers Association President Keith Gamble about this. What does the state's largest teachers union have to say about having metrics in there and deciding about reopening or not?
They want there to be more of a leadership role from the governor's office, the state, just to kind of say what they should be doing. They're hearing from a lot of teachers, members of the union, concern that every district is doing what they want to do. And I think the concerns about safety, the concerns about infection happening in the schools is really concerning them. And I think they really want to hear what is that threshold. At what point should schools pull back versus allowing, you know, the all the districts in the state to decide on their own.
I know you mentioned in you mentioned in your article about Gamble talking with teachers, I guess, on a recent Facebook Live briefing. I was going to say, what all did they have to say? They obviously are the most concerned of anybody about this.
Yeah, I mean, there's fear from them. They discussed the fear of for themselves, some of them, whether it's to their age and their ability for COVID to infect them more easily and have worse consequences, who they live with, bringing home at home. So, you know, they want to educate students. They want to be there, but they are concerned about their own health. And the president of ISTA, you know, said that he was fearful, and he knows other teachers are fearful. They have asked the governor to mandate the face masks in school, was one of their requests that they made to him.
Mm-hmm. Now, did they have any other requests that they wanted to make of the governor and of Dr. Box as well?
You know, I think they just want more guidance is what they are hoping for. You know, there's been a lot of recommendations, and I think right now they are wanting to see more guidance. They have asked for more information, you know, about waiver days. There's information about testing. You know, they have asked that standardized testings be stopped for this year. You know, as I'm sure most parents know, when the iLearn time comes around, you know, formerly iStep, there's a lot of stress, you know, for some schools and some teachers. So they think that they should remove that. There are federal requirements related to states doing that. So it's that would take some kind of action from lawmakers if we did change that.
We're talking with Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Eric Weddle about some of the articles that he has put out there from his reporting work that's out there on the WFII.org website out of Indianapolis. One other story that you mentioned, too, in detail is talking about, an idea that had one time been thought of. It was important, but apparently not so because it got put away. That is a police force review that the Indianapolis Public Schools was going to do, but they changed their mind. Tell us more about that. How did that come about and the results of that?
Sure. Well, I think, the issue of police in general and communities, has come to the national forefront in the wake of the death of George Floyd. And that conversation has now gone into schools. And there are school districts across the country right now that are dealing with whether to allow police officers to remain in their school buildings. A number of years ago, IPS, Indianapolis Public School District, was kind of ahead of this issue. In 2016, they began kind of a systematic review of their police department, and they hired some Indiana University researchers to do that. Well, it turned out the report was never completed, and it kind of got shelved and put away. And so with all these issues coming back, and the concerns of police in school being raised, they say now that they are going to be looking again into that review and providing more information on their police force.
In your article that you have concerning the police force and schools in particular, you talk about, what the makeup had been, maybe at the time, of what most people know as school resource officers, SROs.
Mm-hmm.
But they're typically,
right.
They're just basically the police officers that are assigned to be in schools for whatever reason. And you mentioned about what the IPS police force was all about. Tell us more about that. It may be of interest because some people may not realize how the makeup of these officers are.
Sure. So, most school districts in Indiana, they partner with local law enforcement, sheriff's department, police department, to have those officers, work in their school buildings. IPS is one of just a handful that actually has its own police department. So the force that in Indianapolis is they're a police department that operates, independently.
Mm-hmm.
And so the numbers there, have fallen in recent years. So back in 2015, there were 56 officers and sergeants and 13 civilian staff that were involved in policing the district. And right now, there's only 41 officers and 10 staff. So the size of the force has shrunk in the past years. The cost of it has stayed relatively the same, though, in that same time period. It's around $4.5 million is the budget for that force.
Mm-hmm. And we probably should put a frame of reference here that the Indianapolis Public Schools is the state of Indiana's largest public school system. So with all the schools that are out there, you need to have some sizable size force, to be those SROs, don't you?
Yeah, so right now the department, they have officers that are permanently installed at the high schools, and then they rotate to the elementary schools and are available for those.
I noticed in the article that you put out there had comments from a professor at Johns Hopkins University, Professor Sheldon mm-hmm. Greenberg. He's specifically one who studies policing, and he had some interesting things to say, and I think maybe it has an idea of what we as citizens should think of the police, particularly when they're walking around our school buildings.
Yeah, he talked about, just the fact that there's no guidelines or rules or policies for police forces across America, basically meaning everyone's different. Everyone operates under their own rules, under their own jurisdictions. And so he has kind of said that, he is not against police being removed from schools. He just really wants to stress that there needs to be a very thorough discussion, very thorough analysis from many stakeholders to decide if that's a good idea or not, and to also just answer the question, why do you want police in your schools? He says, that simple question, may stump, some school board members, principals, or people in the community who have different views on this.
Yeah. When you talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, what's that all mm-hmm. about? That's something that maybe most people don't even think about.
Yeah, the school-to-prison pipeline, basically is if you have the police get involved in a discipline issue and some other issue at a school, maybe that student then gets put into the juvenile legal system, and then that could then lead them to being incarcerated later on. And the big concern about that is minority students and students with disabilities are disciplined at a much higher rate, and they do have a much higher rate of ending up in this school-to-prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. And in Indiana, there's federal data that shows that the police are about 2.5 times more likely to arrest a black Indiana student versus other students in the state.
Well, that's interesting. And I know you mentioned that some questions that that Professor Greenberg bring up here, and you talked about some about, you know, why should we have a student resource officer in a school to begin mm-hmm. with, I guess. And a lot of it, and you mentioned some of it too, I guess, even goes back to, and we could even question about the makeup of police departments. What types of officers right. are on hand? What are they qualified to do? What are their qualifications?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think he really feels like if you're going to have police in the schools, you really want to think about, like, who is picking them? You know, are the staff of a school even involved in choosing them? And then are these officers, are they well aware of the dynamics within that school? I mean, I'm sure most places across the state, I know here in Indianapolis, school cultures shift, you know, neighborhood to neighborhood. And you want to make sure these officers are acutely aware of the environment that they're working in, and that's, you know, and that they are, it's going to lead to better policing, according to the professor.
Well, sounds like a lot of questions that need to be not only addressed but answered as well, and but probably now is probably a good time than any to be able to do it, because we know as schools are likely to be reopening some fashion, whether it's in person or virtual, the questions are going to continue to come up too. And Eric, thanks a lot for spending time with us on this and the other stories that you have covered lately here, and we'll hope to have you back on again soon.
Great, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
We're talking with Eric Weddle. He is a reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and in particular with WFYI Public Radio, which is based out of Indianapolis. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Meredith Colias-Pete is a reporter for the Post-Tribune, covers a number of stories, and in fact, a lot of different topics lately here, ranging from stories about NIPSCO cleanups to coronavirus deaths. And Meredith, as always, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks, Chris.
Let's start out here with the NIPSCO Bailey plant. There's a coal ash cleanup plan that is up before federal review and also a public comment period, too. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we're talking about the old NIPSCO, the former NIPSCO Bailey plant over in Chesterton and Porter County. The crux of it is near Chesterton, basically back in the 60s and up until nearly 1980 when the plant was first running. NIPSCO buried coal ash. When you burn coal, you get coal ash as a byproduct when you're generating electricity. They buried coal ash on the ground, in the ground like 25 feet down. And the EPA is monitoring several different sites, several different spills where it's been mixed in with the soil. Basically, there's a specific spot about south, a little bit southeast of where the plant actually is. Mm-hmm. The problem is that they're saying that in that particular fill, that the coal ash is leaching into the groundwater, and it's flowing out into the Indiana Dunes National Park. What they say the primary contaminant of concern, that's kind of just their language for the toxin that they're worried the most about, is boron. They say that, you know, they believe that it's not toxic enough for humans. They're primarily concerned about its effects on plant life and wildlife out there.
One of the other things I know that always comes about here when they have these EPA matters that come up is to be sure to give the opportunity, first off, for people to respond. But I wonder, and you probably noticed this on some other stories related to the Superfund sites, in particular in East Chicago and other places, where you don't always get the number of people show up that really that should be out there saying something about it, and these things will pass without much to do about them.
Well, you know, there's always environmental groups definitely that are really interested, and East Chicago in particular has a lot of community involvement. I mm-hmm. mean, you talk to folks out there, I mean, they're very, very smart, and they know, you know, they know a lot of the rules and regulations, and they show up at these meetings. The issue is that the coal, like I said, the coal ash is leaking into the groundwater, and that's something that they're concerned about. The public comment period lasts until August 19th or so, so folks that are interested can, there's information in the article on how to contact the EPA and give feedback. They're also holding sort of a phone conference on August 3rd or so that you can kind of dial in and ask questions and get more information that way. The plan that they have at this particular spill mm-hmm. on the property is they basically want to dig it up. They're digging up about 100,000 cubic yards of coal ash and soil mix, and they're going to haul it off site. And then they're looking to treat the remaining, like 85,000 cubic yards of what they call the wet fill, which is kind of the coal ash that has gotten into the water supply. There's a process that they're looking to sort of treat it, and the goal is really to kind of stop it from spreading into the surrounding areas.
And so trying to, some way to mediate it some, I suppose, while they can, without having to dig much more up than they have to, apparently, huh?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. We were noting, too, some other toxic waste stories that have come up that you've covered here. In fact, just as recently as this week, about a report that's come out from the Chicago-based Shriver Center for Poverty Law. And this deals with the issues that have come up, and we've mentioned before, in the city of East Chicago. Tell us more about this report and about the impact that problems like this that we see in East Chicago are certainly not one of a kind. There are a lot of them all around the country.
Right. The Shriver Center, I think it was last week, released this report where they said that 70% of Superfund sites, which are the most toxic, sites that the U.S. government has designated as, you know, needing cleanup, 70% of Superfund sites are within a mile of public housing. That obviously echoes, the heartbreaking situation in East Chicago that we've seen where, the whole community is surrounded by an old lead smelter, has seen a lot of, really bad health effects and, environmental effects from that.
Mm-hmm. One of the stories that you've had out there online, we should mention the story itself goes back to the middle of the month here, July 15th, when the latest data came out at the time, but it's still a problem and it's concern about COVID-19 deaths at the Indiana nursing homes. And your story talks about that there are double-digit deaths reported at some of these nursing homes. Bring us up to date if you can, but tell us in general about the problem that has everybody concerned.
Right. Since the COVID-19 pandemic, started, obviously nursing homes have really been one place where the pandemic has really, really hit hard, especially in Indiana. We have about 2,600 or so nursing home deaths so far. About half of them have happened in a nursing home. Now, Indiana, unlike surrounding states, has not publicly disclosed till since April where these deaths are happening. That's a problem for public transparency. That's a problem for these families. Technically, the nursing homes have to, tell the families what's happening, give them regular updates on cases. But we and other newspapers have found plenty of examples of folks that are really, really scrambling for answers and feeling like, for everyone that feels like, the nursing home is informing them, we have other folks that feel like, they have to scramble for answers, if that makes sense. And so the state announced earlier this month that they plan to finally release information from nursing homes, both cases and deaths that have happened, and basic demographics. Originally, that had been planned for release for mid-July, but they said that that's delayed because apparently they've been asking the nursing homes to provide accurate data based, back until the beginning of March or so. And they have said that 30%, and that was maybe since last week, 30% of nursing homes have not responded to their request. So they expect to release this information once they get it. Right now, the timeline is the end of the month. The governor is scheduled to have a press conference later today, so we may find out more information then.
One of the other stories that you had out in print and online as well, too, Meredith, is a story that uses a term that goes back to the Stone Age. We're talking about contact tracers. They've been around for a long time, I think longer than we think. We think it's only because of the pandemic that they've been around, but they've been used for such things as HIV and measles and mumps and tuberculosis. And now COVID-19 is one of the illnesses that the contact tracers are being used for. And I like the term hunter-gatherers. That's an interesting way to put it. Tell us about your story that you had in print in the and online as well on the Post Tribune about this.
Sure. Yeah, like you said, public health people say that contact tracing is one of the best tools to understand and try to control an outbreak of any kind, as you alluded to. For the COVID-19 pandemic, the state has hired about 600 contact tracers, at this point. And their job basically is to call people who, test positive for COVID-19. The lab notifies them. And then they, contact them, they talk to them, they try to, ask them where they've been in the last, 2 weeks, if it's like the gym or a family party or, holiday thing or, church or whatever. And then the goal is to call everyone that they could have been in contact with, you know, to warn them that they could have been exposed, and then, you know, tell them to quarantine for, like, you know, 10 to 14 days or so. So, you know, that's kind of what they do. The question is, and this came up actually in a recent Scientific American article as well, mm-hmm. is, are there enough, you know, does the U.S. have enough contact tracers to do this? We know in Indiana there's about 600 contact tracers right now that have been hired. They're all working from home. Nobody's in a call center, obviously. Indiana said that, you know, if need be, you know, they would hire more. But we know, obviously, cases are rising in Indiana. The National Association of County and City Health Officials back in, like, April or so, you know, sent out a memo saying that ideally a state would need 30 contact tracers per 100,000 people. Indiana has almost 7 million people in the whole state. That means 2,000 contact tracers. Mm-hmm. So we know at this point that Indiana really only has 30% of a recommended number. Of course, that's not unique to states, you know, so that's really a problem for the whole country right now.
So I guess the most important thing is that if you get the call, answer the call. And I know it's really tough with caller ID, and especially if you don't know who that caller happens to be, but there's a good reason that they're calling you, for some very, very good reason, I'd say, the health of yourself and your family members and the rest of the community as well, too. Meredith Kolias-Peets, a reporter for the Post Tribune. And as always, Meredith, thank you for spending time with us, going over the stories that you put out there in print and online.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking. As we pivot and head into the second half of 2020, Inside Indiana Business is taking inventory on how big of a hit that COVID-19 has delivered to Indiana's economy. The damage runs deep. State and local governments are facing huge tax revenue losses for the year that could run as high as $700 million. Unemployment continues to hover in double digits, and thousands of Hoosier businesses are struggling to survive. Ball State University Director for the Center for Business and Economic Research, Mike Hicks, shares his insight with Gary Dick now on what Indiana's economic recovery might look like.
The COVID-19 pandemic has forced a really unprecedented volatility in economic activity, skyrocketing unemployment, business failures, and a lot of uncertainty about the future. While there is great variation in opinion regarding the potential depth and duration of the downturn, many suggest 2020 could go down as the worst year for economic growth since the Great Depression. Now, for perspective and what we might expect here in Indiana in the second half of the year, pleased to be joined, as always, by the director of Ball State Center for Business and Economic Research, Mike Hicks. And Mike, as always, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Fairly gloomy introduction there, but as we get into this, you and your group at Ball State recently released a report really zeroing in on the economic impact to state and local government here in Indiana from the pandemic. And again, hard to overstate the devastation that may be wrought from the pandemic.
Right. Well, second quarter of this year is the worst quarter of GDP loss in recorded history dating back to the 1920s. The unemployment rate, depending on how it's measured nationally, we've lost, you know, one out of every five workers from January. We're a little bit better off in Indiana. I think if we could properly measure it, the unemployment rate here would be just under 15%.
Wow.
So these are Great Depression levels of job losses and loss of economic activity. And so as we think about what that does to state and local taxes at the state level, you know, loss of tax dollars somewhere between $2.1 and $2.4 billion over the next couple of years. That doesn't include extra expenditures to test and to take care of other things that are COVID-related, just revenue losses. And for local governments, the impact is, you know, somewhat smaller overall, but there are, you know, 20 to 30 counties that are facing perhaps double-digit revenue losses, some extraordinarily high through 2022 and even into 2023.
Mike, as you look around the state of Indiana at particular municipalities or communities, are some more susceptible or face a greater impact than others?
Yes. So, and it stands to reason, if you have a casino or a casino-like activity in your county, that's a huge revenue source. So those counties that host casinos are losing a significant share of revenues, much as 40, 50% A lot of that's shared with other communities and other activities, but that's a big revenue shock. If you have a heavy reliance on local income taxes, which are more volatile than property taxes, or if you have a lot of food and beverage taxes like Marion County, that's going to make your impact of this COVID much more significant. And then finally, if you have an economy that's dominated by those high-risk service sectors, the casinos, of course, but accommodations, retail, restaurants, those sectors, the counties and municipal governments with those in their community are at extraordinary risk over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I guess a silver lining, if you will, is the economic health of the state heading into the pandemic, the rainy day fund and where Indiana was at that point. Does that soften the blow a bit? And how does that factor in?
Absolutely. Now, 2019 was a tough year by year's end for the state economy. But we ended with a $2.1 billion rainy day fund. The governor pulled back some of the expenditures from the last session. So we entered this pandemic with about $2.4 billion in a rainy day fund. And with the CARES Act, which gave a similar amount to the state government in order to take care of expenditures related to COVID, we'll probably get through the most likely scenario without the sort of dramatic reduction in services. A couple challenges here are we don't know what extra costs for schooling might be. I mean, I've heard estimates of $1 million or more dollars per school to equip them for COVID. That doesn't include, you know, broadband and technology to do online education. So that the state of our fiscal health going into this COVID is going to make us a lot better off than states that had no rainy day fund or had big unfunded liabilities on the revenue side.
I only have about 30 seconds left, Mike, but want to get your take on the second half of 2020, the outlook for Indiana, heavy manufacturing state, obviously. What do you see in the second half of the year?
So we're going to recover some from the big shock from second quarter. You know, GDP loss 15 to 20%, a big shock in jobs, almost 20%, at least had some temporary layoffs. But we're not going to get back to where we were for a couple of years. I think GDP will end 2020 about 5.5 to 6% beneath where we were in 2019. That would make this the worst year for GDP and unemployment since 1937.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Not a lot of great news there, Mike, but great perspective as always. Really appreciate it. Mike Hicks from Ball State University.
That was Inside Indiana Business host Gary Dick talking with Michael Hicks, who is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University. Carlette Duffy became Indianapolis's director of reentry just 1 month before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan spoke with Duffy by phone about the challenges facing people that are going through reentry right now.
So for a lot of the individuals who are new to reentry, those who have not been away from the justice system for very long and who may still be under community supervision, a lot of those individuals had the jobs that were the first to let go. So you have those that were in the hospitality industry, working in hotels, in restaurants, especially in a lot of the small businesses that were forced to close. Those are the number one employers for people with criminal histories because they're more likely to give individuals a chance. That, with the loss of income, the issue of everything that goes with that. So housing then becomes an issue, food insecurity, and it's heightened to a new level.
And we know, you know, so many more people in the food line, so many more people that may be at risk of eviction. It's just making everything compounded that much more. Are you seeing that it's becoming even more of a challenge?
Oh, definitely. Before the pandemic, it was obvious that this group, this demographic, needed the help. But now you have everyone's into the pot of needing help. So then there's a conversation that occurs that is, okay, so now why are we choosing to help one group or the other? Why would we be more specific about helping people with criminal histories? So trying to have a carve out for individuals, you know, with criminal histories for specific funds and resources becomes a lot more challenging, especially in the, you know, the public safety.
And when we're talking about public safety, you know, justice reform is a huge part of that. And, you know, with the conversation being so out in the open lately, do you see that people are understanding that more?
There is a better understanding from the public. There are others who work in the justice group that we have to work at creating a balance with in terms of how far we go. Personally, for myself, I know the struggle of being on community corrections and electronic monitoring. And at that time, the max was $12 a day. Now the max is $14 a day. And so you're talking about over $5,000 over the course of the year that you can't pay because you don't have a job. It adds that much more stress on top of being able to deal with the daily stressors.
What's making you hopeful, you know, as we all try to work all this out?
With the changes that have occurred, it has allowed us to start thinking outside of the realm. So, like for me, a big piece that I would like to provide is financial, not only financial training, but with a credit recovery that allow individuals to really look at where they stand financially and to grow them so that when they are ready to maybe get the new job or to get the new housing or even to get an expungement, they're prepared because now they know where they stand with their credit, and to know where you are financially can alleviate a lot of the stresses. You know, mental health services is another huge one that I'm looking to get people involved in. And it's really exciting to see that there may be options and opportunities that are opening up because of everything that has happened.
Thank you again so much.
You're very welcome.
That was Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Jill Sheridan talking to Indianapolis Office of Public Health and Safety Reentry Director Carlette Duffy. That's it for today and for this week. Our thanks to Eric Weddle, Jill Sheridan, and Meredith Colias-Pete for reporting the stories. And I'm Chris Nolte, back with you on Monday.